Tensions are ratcheting up between Turkey and Greece once again over two Aegean islands near the Turkish coast. But a quick history check shows that Greece and Turkey, which are both part of NATO, have feuded for years over maritime borders and energy exploration rights in the Aegean and East Mediterranean seas. In this edition of the program, we will look at whether this crisis between the two can escalate into a possible military confrontation or not, and how this will affect the Eastern Mediterranean region as a whole. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos joins us from London. Also joining us, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Istanbul Bilgi University, İlter Turan, joins us from Istanbul.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. So let me first start with you, Marcus Papadopoulos, and taking a look at this crisis at the present time that has the two heating up again against each other. Greece deploying U.S. armored vehicles on these two islands, and the ships are loaded with what is said to be U.S. armored vehicles. First question that comes up is, why is Greece deploying these vehicles onto the two islands?
Well, let it be said that the terrible level of tension which exists between Turkey and Greece, coupled with the pure hatred in existence between the two countries, is a profound demonstration of NATO disunity. It is also a profound demonstration of why, when NATO leaders claim that the Western military bloc is unified, they are lying, because NATO is full of divisions. There is great tension between Turkey and Bulgaria. There is tension between Hungary and Romania, and there is tension between Bulgaria and North Macedonia. But turn into the crisis in the Aegean Sea. Erdogan, like his predecessors, is threatening the independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of Greece. Greece is a member of the United Nations, and its borders are internationally recognized. Secondly, Erdogan, again like his predecessors, is pursuing a greater Turkey, like how a greater Albania is being pursued in the Balkans. And thirdly, Erdogan, in threatening the status quo in the Aegean Sea, is effectively undermining the Treaty of Lausanne of 1923, because the Treaty of Lausanne underpins the status quo in the Aegean Sea.
Sure. Do you agree with our guest there, İlter Turan?
I don't know where to start from, but let me say that this unity of NATO, which the gentleman has referred to, is of course true, but then NATO was established for a specific purpose which did not preclude disagreement among its members. In fact, we had some actual fighting as NATO was an anti-Soviet bloc treaty. We had fighting among allies, namely, this is always the case. In fact, as the reason why NATO was formed declines in importance, there is a greater tendency among its members to fall into disagreements. Now, I was fascinated by the gentleman's giving examples of how there are differences between allies, and he referred to a disagreement between Bulgaria and Turkey. I'm not aware of it, but I'm aware of a number of bad relations Greece has with its neighbors, but I will not go into that. I think the question of having weapons on these islands puts the argument that national sovereignty is above international law. And about
well, let me jump in and quickly, if you don't mind. No, I just want to ask you, before you continue, I want to ask you, is what has happened legal or not?
It is illegal. There's no question about that. I mean, you know, according to the treaties of both Lausanne and Paris, Greece is not permitted to arm these islands. Now, the reason Greece is presumably arming these islands is because it is its sovereign right. If we buy that argument, then international agreements have no meaning. And also, let me make one final observation. The gentleman suggested that a number of countries in the region were expansionist. There is really one truly expansionist country in the region, and that is Greece itself. Just look at the map of Greece after wars and what has happened, and it has constantly kept expanding. You look at Turkey after it was founded as a republic, and there is no expansion with the exception of a couple of international agreements. So if there is an expansionary power to be identified in the region, everybody knows who that is.
Marcus Papadopoulos, so is Greece expansionary or Turkey?
What you have just heard from the guest in Istanbul is an inversion of the truth. It is absolutely preposterous to claim that Greece is an expansionist country. Let us look at the facts. Turkey illegally occupies a part of the Republic of Cyprus. Turkey illegally occupies a part of Syria. Turkey, at its will, supported by both America and Britain, invades northern Iraq when it chooses to. Furthermore, it is not Greece which is calling into question Turkey's territorial integrity in accordance with the Treaty of Lausanne. It is Turkey which is doing so. So, quite frankly, the guest in Istanbul does not have a legal or political leg to stand on. And we have to address the reasons as to why Greece is why Greece has deployed military hardware to the islands in question, because Erdogan is making territorial claims against them. The Treaty of Lausanne stipulates that Greece must not establish naval bases on those islands, and Athens has not done so.
Very well. But so that's a point that we need our guests to address, because that is what the agreement specified, isn't it? That you basically are banned from building naval bases or fortifications on these islands, in this particular case, Lesbos and Samos. Isn't that true?
Apparently, the gentleman is very selective about the reading of the treaty. Actually, Greece is allowed to have law enforcement forces on the island, but nothing else, no military figures. So, but then, let me turn back to some of the allegations the gentleman is felt fully free to volunteer. Of course, it may have escaped the gentleman's attention that the Turkish presence in Syria and in Iraq is not one of claiming that this is Turkish territory. It's not incorporating that, but it is according to the Adana Accords that Turkish forces are in Syria. And it is, again, according to agreements with the Iraqi government in 1998 that the Turkish forces are in northern Iraq. And the moment the particular reason why they're there is gone, Turkey has no claims on the territory of these countries. So I think this is imaginary. With Cyprus, I guess the gentleman has forgotten that the conditions under which Turkey intervened on Cyprus. First of all, it's not Greece, incidentally. Let's make that clear. It's not Greece, but it was a military takeover engineered by the Greek government that was that essentially warranted mm-hmm. Turkish intervention on the island. And Turks were being literally ethnically cleansed so that this intervention was okay. to stop ethnic cleansing.
I think our guest wants to say something in reaction to your statements. Go ahead, Marcus.
Indeed. Turkey is a guarantor, or was a guarantor, of the Republic of Cyprus prior to its invasion of the island in July of 1974. So there were two stages in the Turkish invasion. Attila I effectively put a stop to the coup in Nicosia. That effectively also brought down the military regime in Athens. So therefore, Attila I restored the status quo to the Republic of Cyprus. So why did Turkey then, in August of 1974, launch Attila II when the status quo had already been restored by Attila I? I put that to the gentleman in Istanbul.
Okay, a quick response, because we've got to move beyond this, because there are other areas of friction and crises between the two that involve a lot of other countries at the same time. Go ahead.
Gentleman has forgotten the fact that Turks were being killed right and left on the island. So that's all I've got to say.
Can you explain Attila II?
All right, let's move on. This is what's interesting here. And Ildar, let me address this to you. Ildar Turan, if I may. You're having Turkey react to what has occurred because you have hardware that was donated by Washington, which is said to be, let me read here, 23 and 18 vehicles respectively, donated to Athens. Now, I'm looking at 41 vehicles. I don't think anybody in the right mind would just donate 41 vehicles. What is the purpose behind the U.S. donating these vehicles to Greece?
Well, you have to ask that question to the Americans. Apparently, I mean, their ostensible reason is that they are setting up a defense line against Russian expansion, which they find is threatening. And because it is difficult to access the Black Sea through Turkey, because the Montreux Convention does not give foreign warships the liberty of moving in and out of the Black Sea, this sort of Greece, Bulgaria, Romania connection is presumably a way into the Black Sea. But it also appears that the United States is setting up a second line of defense because it doesn't think it can rely on Turkey for NATO purposes sufficiently. And Greece has been made into a depot of U.S. armaments. They're increasing on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And I think because of this changed American position, Greeks have come under the illusion that somehow the United States is ready to defend them. Obviously, great states don't let small states to lead them into conflicts. And it is always important to remember that.
All right, so let's move on here to oil and gas explorations. Marcus, we only have another 12 minutes, even less, but this whole thing is so wide, and the number of countries that are involved are so many when you really dig into this. What are we looking at? We know both Turkey and Greece, they're in a race to develop these energy resources in the Eastern Mediterranean, but they're on separate sides. Where are we going with that, if you can tell us, and what's legal and illegal when it comes to oil explorations in terms of who has the right and who doesn't?
Well, America doesn't favor Greece over Turkey. Indeed, historically, America has favored Turkey over Greece. Why? Because Turkey is of immense geostrategic importance to Washington. And the reason as to why the Americans have supplied the Greek armed forces with these vehicles, which Athens has now deployed to the islands in the Aegean Sea, is because of Erdogan. Firstly, America has
but
a problematic
two NATO
relationship.
Aren't they both NATO members? I mean, if they're NATO members, they shouldn't work off each other. I guess that goes back to your division statement, right?
Yes, absolutely. NATO is not unified. NATO is a very divided military bloc. But this is all aimed at Erdogan. Firstly, America has a problematic relationship with Erdogan, not with the Turkish state, not with the Turkish establishment, but with Erdogan. So the Americans are sending a message to Erdogan by giving the Greek army.
Okay, I got to get a reaction from our guest in Istanbul.
Well, it's about
Russia. Do you agree, Ilter Tunar? Do you agree with our guest there?
I'm curious about this explanation reduced down to a person who happens to be the president of Turkey at this time. I'm not an admirer of him, mind you, but I have seen no indication that his government has any plans to invade any Greek island. And there is no feeling in Turkey that they want to invade a neighboring our country's territory. This is entirely false. And, you know,
it's
interestingly
not a question
enough,
which was put to you.
Let me just say that for the most part, many Turks feel Erdogan was more an American creation. So as to why they are trying to stop him now, if that is the case, would be a very interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we got to dig into this oil and gas exploration because that has been brought up to a point where there have been other countries involved, because I'm going to skip as to the legality or the illegality, but, you know, this involves a number of countries. We're looking at Cyprus. We're looking at France to have gotten involved. We're looking at the possible military aspect to this. Back in 2020 is when there was really points where you had Rafale jets from France, Marcus, that were flown into that area where there were really heated exchanges. What are we looking at when it comes to that? Because it's not getting resolved, obviously.
The Americans have gathered their allies in the region in what I describe as an Eastern Mediterranean gathering involving Greece, Cyprus, Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, and of course Britain and France, together naturally with America, because there are vast reserves of oil and gas there. And of course, the Americans ultimately want to secure that for themselves. And they will do that by their Eastern Mediterranean gathering. That is another reason as to why I have long contended that American supremacy in West Asia is not on the way out. It is not eroding. If anything, it has been boosted by gathering Washington's friends and allies in the region. But Turkey has not been included. Why? Not because of Turkey per se, but because Erdogan is not playing ball, so to speak, especially when it concerns Russia. Erdogan is intensifying Turkey's economic relationship with America, with Russia, and that is to great annoyance and to great fury of policymakers in Washington. Mm-hmm. So again, that is why the Americans have supplied the Greek armed forces with this weaponry. It's a message to Erdogan, not to Turkey, to Erdogan.
Ilter Turan, a Turkey publication and media organization that's very well known, has ran this headline where experts believe Greece's increasing violations of Turkish airspace is part of an agenda that's been encouraged by the West to corner Turkey for taking an independent foreign policy. That in particular obviously falls squarely on Erdogan and his stance. Do you agree with that or not?
But actually, I don't agree with that, because when we look at the history of the relations, such allegations have been there all along. The gentleman in London introduced the Russian equation to the discussion. And, you know, Turkish-Russian relations got on the road to improvement ever since the end of the Soviet Union. It's nothing new. So I think this is one thing. Secondly, the argument that this area is blessed with immense amount of natural resources is still something that waits to be proven. In fact, the gentleman's attention may have been away when the United States decided that the idea of building a pipeline, for example, was simply uneconomical. And that is why there are current discussions between Israel and Turkey with regard to whether it would not be possible to connect the Israeli gas to the Turkish pipeline system. So, you know, the critical thing is that this sort of economic zone discussions are political. They need to be political. All the riparian countries need to be incorporated into a discussion. It's not that you could organize some against the others. You have to get them all if you want stability and peace and prosperous exploitation of resources.
Okay. Well, we need to expand more on why you have chosen Erdogan and separated him, Marcus Papadopoulos, from the Turkey equation, because that's very interesting, because you have the way that either coming from Turkey or otherwise, that Erdogan is purely trying to be separated from Turkey, and he's the one that they want to corner. Are they going to be successful in doing that? Because you can't separate, you know, him from Turkey at this point anyways.
The Americans are masters in understanding and having the capabilities to manage difficult relationships. There have been times in the past when American allies and friends have leaders who have been problematic to Washington. But Washington knows that Turkey will always be a staunch friend and ally to America. Turkey will always be in existence, but Erdogan will not always be in existence. That is why the Americans know that their strategic partnership with Turkey is as firm as it has ever been before. There is no tension between the American and Turkish establishments, but for the Americans, they are having problems with Erdogan. Like how there is no tension between the Israeli and Turkish establishments, there is tension between the Israeli establishment and Erdogan.
Thank you very much for that, Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author from London. And Ilter Turan from Istanbul, thank you. Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Istanbul Bilgi University. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitahway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Principles of Friendship. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome everyone. In today's lesson, we are talking about the principles of friendship. Now, when you're talking about principles of friendship, we are definitely looking at something that is going to build up a good relationship between two people who've just met outside. They've never been together since they were born. They just met at a workplace. They just met at a football ground. They just met on their way, maybe to some, you've been on a journey, you've been in a bus, you're traveling, and you met someone, you talk to each other, and boom, you two people have become friends. So alhamdulillah, now you've become friends. What are the principles that we need to use to make sure that this particular bonding, this particular relationship between these two people who didn't know each other before, can become a good relationship, a relationship that can build the future of these two people and make them better people in their lives? One of the things that we're looking at here, that we need, one of the principles that we're trying to outline and make sure that it's going to work, is the principles of sharing between the two people. Having to share from my side to the other side. I've met this person. I don't know them. They are not my brother. They're not anything in my life, but we just met. How can I improve my relationship with them? One of the best things that you need to do is to improve the act of sharing. because the Holy Quran has outlined the sacrifices made by the righteous companions of the Holy Prophet between themselves as brothers. You know, during the life of the Holy Prophet, he used to have his companions, not just as companions. He used to have them as friends also. And they really used to be so righteous to the Holy Prophet, and him too, the Holy Prophet, used to be righteous to them. They used to share with each other. They lived in a sincere friendship. Let's give an example of the people of Ansar. They shared a lot to the Muhajirun. The history tells us. This definitely shows that the act of sharing between friendship is something that can build a love between the two of the people who just met. So let's improve it. We're coming back in a few minutes.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hossein Hinzano. Now, we are talking about the principles of friendship. Now, we are trying to analyze on how we can build up a good and a successful friendship between two people by them looking at the principles of friendship, them improving the good principles of friendship. So one of the main principles that we've just been talking about in this show, it's sharing between two people, sharing between two friends. And we say that sharing really builds a very good feeling between the two people. It increases the love between you two by just sharing. You met that person in the bus, share together whatever you have. Share your thoughts, share your money, share your time, anything that you could share. Because anyone in this world, as much as he is, so long as he is in this world, he needs help from each other. He needs something from the other party, the other person that he's living with. He will need at a time money from you. He will need an advice. Sometimes he will need just a mental build-up. He will need just a spiritual build-up. He'll need you just to uplift him spiritually by telling him good words of God. So sharing is one of the main aspects that is going to make friendship be very successful, as the companions of the Prophet used to be. The Holy Quran says, "And those who made their abode in the city and in faith before them love those who have fled to them and find in their hearts no need of what they are given and prefer. They prefer them before themselves, though poverty may afflict them. And whoever is saved from the niggardliness of his soul, this it is that are the successful." Here, the holy verse is just trying to outline that by sharing shows that you're a better person. By sharing between you two, shows you having to look at your friend and want what's better for them. You see that this particular thing is good for me. Let me also offer it for my friend to have it. By doing this, you're building that friendship, you're completing it, you're making it better day by day. So sharing is one of the main things that can improve our friendship. Thank you so much for listening to this show. Until next episode, inshallah. Fi amanillah, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Largely predicted by pollsters, the Brothers of Italy party has won the most votes in Italy's snap election, leading a right-wing coalition to victory. The turnout for the general election was about 64%, the lowest percentage ever recorded, around 9 points lower than the 73% turnout for the 2018 general election. Brothers of Italy, a group founded 10 years ago by its leader, Giorgia Meloni, grabbed more than 26% of the vote, while its allies, the League, and the more moderate Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia received respectively 9 and 8%. Meloni said on Monday that a future centre-right government would not betray the trust of the Italian people.
Questo è il tempo della responsabilità.
This is a time for responsibility. This is a time in which, if you want to be part of history, you must realize that we have responsibility towards millions of people who chose us. We won't betray it, like we never have.
Meloni's flagship policies include defending traditional social values, anti-immigration programs, and the reduction of taxes. Meloni is slated to become the next prime minister, the first woman in Italy who has ever been appointed to that position. The news that a coalition led by Brothers of Italy won a decisive victory in Italy's snap elections has been welcomed by far-right parties from across Europe. The Brothers of Italy has relentlessly advocated for a free Europe, including sovereign countries, and promoted traditional values and essentialist conceptions of gender.
Certainly it won't be an easy task for Meloni to reassure the EU, other international partners and the moderate electorate, and at the same time maintain a strong connection with international populist groups and a more radical electorate. I don't think Meloni will ever find a way to mediate between these issues. That's why I believe her policies won't be too bold.
Among the defeated coalitions in Italy's national elections was the Democratic Party, growingly seen by a large number of Italians as the party of the establishment. Its leader Enrico Letta conceded defeat early on Monday, adding that his party would be the largest opposition force in the next parliament.
It is evident that mistakes were made. I will lead the next party until the next Congress, when a new leader will be determined.
According to the Italian constitution, newly elected members of the parliament must now meet within 20 days. The country's president, Sergio Mattarella, will begin consultations on who should be appointed as the new prime minister with the presidents of the Senate and Chamber of Deputies, the leaders of the main parties, and, at a later stage, with parliamentary groups. Max Civili, Rome.
The British pound takes a pounding yet again, only days after the country's finance minister announced the biggest tax-cutting package in decades, all funded by borrowing at a time of high inflation. They termed it a mini-budget, but it was a mega shift in direction. The Chancellor confirmed the government would implement Prime Minister Liz Truss's leadership campaign pledges to reverse the national insurance rise, cancel the corporation tax rise, and a surprise new tax cut for the highest earners.
Take the additional rate of income tax. At 45%, it is currently higher than the headline top rate in G7 countries like the US and Italy. And it is even higher than social democracies like Norway. But I'm not going to cut the additional rate of tax today, Mr. Speaker. I'm going to abolish it altogether.
Ordinary Britons may not think about exchange rates on a daily basis, but a fall in the pound will affect their day-to-day.
Britain imports nearly half of its foodstuffs, and therefore the pound gets weaker, the cost of that those basic foodstuffs goes up dramatically. And so anything which is coming in will be hitting inflation at a time when you don't want to have that. The only good news part of actually of this would be actually your exports are now better value. The trouble is if the global demand is shrinking, therefore the demand for those exports would also be shrinking.
There are also concerns about a long recession as winter looms with no end in sight to the energy crisis or the war in Ukraine. Online calls for a general election are gaining traction. And in the Conservative Party itself, rumors about a no-confidence vote in the brand new prime minister.
Some experts say the UK's central bank, the Bank of England, could intervene to halt the pound sliding. Many others are saying the government's decision to borrow its way out of the current situation could end in tears. Saeed Burizap, London.
The crisis hit Lebanon is once again a scene of angry masses. The parliament is back to meet and debate a new budget. Yet protesters see the budget being discussed as elusive.
Instead of putting together a budget which encourages development in agriculture, industrial production, and all fields in Lebanon, they want to impoverish the people and push them to die in the sea as they immigrate illegally. The government which relies on debt is being controlled by a mob, which is the Banks Association and the Central Bank. They should be held accountable for getting billions of dollars out of the country.
Banks reopened partially on Monday following a week-long closure in the wake of a wave of holdups. Depositors stormed at least 7 bank branches in the capital and abroad demanding their trapped savings.
We know these banks, you know, where we invested our money. But unfortunately, they stole the money between themselves, and they plan, and every time they create a story.
One woman named Saleh Hafiz forced one branch to give her $13,000 of her savings, saying she needed it to pay for her sister's medical treatment. But she didn't take back her money on her own.
They left us no other choice. We encouraged Sally, and we were with her when she held up the bank, because it was a humanitarian situation, and we will be with all the people who urgently need their money. Our government is rotten and corrupt, and so is the judicial system.
The government has been procrastinating while time is running out. The governmental institutions, including schools, are almost out of service.
The entire governmental sector is paralyzed. The workers, the military personnel, the ministerial workers, the public teachers, they all have rights and they can barely do their job. There's no health care, no educational assistance. The budget plan the parliament is debating today is unfair.
Lebanon's economic downfall began in October 2019. The Lebanese pound has lost around 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar, but officials have failed to put in place necessary reforms. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Over 50 million Italians have been called to cast their ballot in what could be a pivotal election, as Italy and a number of EU countries reel from repercussions of the conflict in Ukraine. The cost of energy has increased by 80% on average across the country compared to a year ago, while at the current rate, inflation is expected to reach 15% in 2023. With a growing number of Italians saying they've lost trust in politics, a high level of abstention from voting, much higher than the record low of 73% in the 2018 general elections, has been predicted.
I don't favor any of the candidates. I see little individual seriousness. As a matter of fact, I didn't want to vote at all. I only came to the polls out of my civic sense.
The electoral law must be changed. Those who deserve to rule are not rewarded. I have great distrust of the electoral system and of Italy's politics.
According to the current electoral law, which has already been reviewed twice by the Constitutional Court, citizens cannot pick their favorite candidates on the ballot. They can only vote for blocked lists. It's the parties themselves who will decide which candidates get the votes.
Last time a government was chosen by voters was 13 years ago when Berlusconi won the elections. All the elected governments that have followed have been overturned and replaced with executives of the establishment.
According to pollsters, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. The Democratic Party comes second with around 22% of preferences. Brothers of Italy party leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, is predicted to become Italy's first ever female prime minister, heading a coalition that features anti-immigration populist Matteo Salvini and 85-year-old media tycoon Silvio Berlusconi. Meloni's flagship policies include defending traditional social values, anti-immigration programs, and the reduction of taxes. She has been supporting sanctions against Moscow so far, while Salvini and Berlusconi have recently said they should be reconsidered. Political analysts believe it could take weeks before a government is installed in the country. Some even say Italians will likely only see a new executive in November. However, if everything goes as expected, Giorgia Meloni stands as the next prime minister. Max Civili, Rome.
The Israeli military has announced a series of closures on the Palestinian territories that will be imposed during a number of Jewish holidays. The first lockdown is imposed for the new Jewish year called Rosh Hashanah and will last till Tuesday midnight. During the closure, all checkpoints between the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and Israel will remain closed. This means Palestinians who have Israeli-issued permits are not allowed to enter Al-Quds and lands occupied in 1948. The Israeli army routinely seals off the West Bank on Jewish holidays, but the closure for the Palestinians is yet another form of the collective punishment that Palestinians have to bitterly endure because of the Israeli occupation.
Closure of the Palestinian territories, including the West Bank cities and refugee camps, comes as part of the collective punishment imposed by the Israeli regime under the pretext of celebrating the new Jewish year. It also imposes more rules on the Palestinians. This measure is part of a widespread war that's meant to strengthen the occupation.
This year, the closure comes at a sensitive time due to rising armed confrontations between Israeli forces and Palestinians in the West Bank. Early on Sunday, another Palestinian was killed during Israeli military raid on Nablus. The Israeli military claimed its troops identified a group of armed Palestinians driving near Nablus. Regime troops opened fire at them, killing Saeed Al-Kouni, and took his body. Three more Palestinians were wounded during the operation.
The Israeli troops claim the operation came under the routine raids, but what's happening is a barbaric act. They are murdering more Palestinians in cold blood. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone. It's clear there is a green light from the Israeli regime and its army to kill more youths under the pretext of confronting resistance fighters.
Meanwhile, scores of Jewish settlers escorted by police broke into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds and performed rituals in its compound. The Israeli military has already increased its military presence across the occupied Palestinian territories even before the start of Jewish holidays. This comes amid the regime's atrocities and military operations to prevent Palestinians' resistance. Mona Khandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Rome's suburban Tiburtino Terzo Quarter is once again home to a new edition of the Palestine Festival, a four-day initiative organized by the Palestinian Association of Rome and Lazio Region and the Palestinian Youth Association, created by Palestinian expat Youssef Salman with the aim to foster intercultural understanding and promoting Palestinian culture in the Italian capital. This year's edition of the festival also has a focus on Palestine and Latin America.
Many Latin American countries have been supporting the Palestinian cause. That's what I told to the people who attended the meeting this evening. I also told them about our President Abbas being in New York to discuss a two-state solution. But when will Israel sit at the negotiation table?
A number of Latin American heads of state came out and spoke loudly, proclaiming the rights of the Palestinians and denouncing the Israeli persecution against them at the UN over the past days. At Rome's Palestine Festival, diplomats from the Bolivian, Cuban, and Venezuelan embassies reiterated their support for the cause of Palestinian people in order to restore their legitimate rights. A commemoration of Shirin Abu Akleh was held during a panel on the dreadful living conditions of Palestinian journalists in the occupied territories. Recently, a new forensic analysis proved that the Israeli sniper who killed her could see that Shirin was a journalist before firing the bullet.
In the West Bank, journalists are shot, wounded, or arrested. In the Gaza Strip, there is no internet, no power. We cannot work. Israel simply doesn't want us to do our job. 55 Palestinian journalists have been killed by the Israeli forces in about 20 years. In regards to Shirin, Israeli soldiers knew full well she was a journalist when they killed her. It was a warning sent to all of us journalists in Palestine.
The Palestine Festival will continue on Saturday with an initiative commemorating the Sabra and Shatila massacre and a conference on Italy's and the EU's political stance on the plight of the Palestinians. Max Civili, Rome.
It's the third time since Friday that Iranians assemble en masse to call the nation for peace. This gathering is in fact a response to days of nationwide street violence and riots that erupted in Iran following the death of Mahsa Amini, a young Iranian woman who died on September 16th, days after she was taken into a police station. The demonstrators here say while they sympathize with Mahsa's death, they don't want the violent protests to go on.
We are too waiting for the investigation to shed light on Mahsa's death. We are all saddened by her death. But unfortunately, some people are committing vandalism in the name of Mahsa. They're desecrating our sanctities in her name.
It's not about Ms. Amini. Those people who have violated law and order have used Mahsa's death as an excuse to incite unrest in our country. They have destroyed public properties and burned our flag, which represents our identity.
Police have rejected claims that Mahsa Amini was mistreated, saying no physical contact happened between officers and Amini. Now, violent protests and acts of vandalism come while Iranian authorities have given assurances that a thorough investigation is underway into her death. Here, people describe the rioters as foreign-backed elements who are exploiting the death of Mahsa Amini to instigate chaos and wreak havoc across the country.
I believe Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the U.S. are trying to use the issue of Mahsa Amini through their media propaganda to sow divisions among Iranians and deal a blow to the Islamic Republic. But they will never achieve their goals because our nation will stay united.
22-year-old Mahsa was an Iranian Kurd from the city of Saqqez in Kurdistan province. On September 13th, she was on a trip to Tehran with her family when she was taken by police. Police have released the CCTV footage showing Bassar suddenly collapsing on the ground and then later being brought to an ambulance.
People here say they're all grieved for Bassar's unfortunate fate. And they say the issue should not divide Iranians and harm national security. Yusuf Jalil, Tehran.
Palestinians rallied in Gaza following the Friday prayer to condemn Israeli violations against Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. Protesters condemned the Israeli provocative measures, vowing to protect Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa. In recent days, Israeli regime forces have increased their presence near Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, taking advantage of Jewish holidays. Dozens of Jewish settlers were also allowed to storm the Holy Shrine and perform religious rituals. Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque, emphasizing that any provocative move against the sacred site will only infuriate Palestinians.
The Zionist criminal enemy is playing with fire and gunpowder that will only explode in its face. The enemy must not forget the sword of Al-Quds battle. If the Zionists continue to desecrate Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, we will wage bigger battles against them.
Palestinian officials accused Arab regimes who normalized ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against Al-Quds.
Those Arab and Islamic countries who normalized their ties with the Zionist enemy are encouraging it to violate and desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. Those countries have lost their moral compass and must correct their mistakes before it's too late.
Protesters slammed British Prime Minister Liz Truss for promising Israeli regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid to consider relocating the British embassy to Al-Quds. Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the eternal capital of Palestine.
We came here today to support Al-Aqsa and to say to the whole world that Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line. We also want to condemn the British Prime Minister's statements about relocating the British embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds.
Palestinians have also condemned the international community's silence on Israeli crimes in Al-Quds.
Analysts say the Israeli regime and its regional and international backers are responsible for the escalation of violence in Al-Quds and Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The pressure from the cost of living crisis, driven by soaring energy costs, due in part to the war in Ukraine, is pushing more and more Britons into poverty, among them people with jobs. Across the nation, business after business has also closed up shop. More could follow. The government's answer, unleashing tens of billions of dollars to protect businesses from rising energy costs. But for many, such measures don't go far enough.
People are still suffering quite big energy and inflation, you know, and real wage cuts. But not if you're at the top end. You're actually going to be delighted with your extra 5% tax cut on your million-pound salary. I mean, it is ludicrous.
A global shortage of essentials from fuel to flour have seemingly made everything more expensive. Inflation in the UK stands at just under 10%, the highest in 40 years and highest across all G7 countries. In response, the Bank of England has raised interest rates, the cost of borrowing, to their highest in more than a decade to try and slow down people's spending and bring down prices.
The government is moving in a different direction, slashing taxes to get people to spend more. Good news for businesses on, for example, high street, but bad news for inflation.
Now, Mr. Speaker, this brings me to the cap on bankers' bonuses.
New Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng has announced cuts to taxes on richest individuals and the biggest companies, along with lifting the cap on bankers' bonuses. He and his prime minister's theory is that if the rich are allowed to get richer, instead of shouldering more of the nation's tax burden, everyone will benefit. And it has a name, trickle-down economics. Very few economists think it's a good idea.
I don't think this is going to be received well by the British public. What we want is an improved health service, dealing with social care, and this is not the time to be cutting tax on the wealthy like this. It is, as I say, astonishingly inept.
In the past 10 years of Conservative government, the UK has experienced stagnated productivity investment and wages. Many are questioning whether this government can really turn the tide on years of economic decline. Saeed Puriza, London.
In the limelight.
Economic inflation is continuing in America, and prices move faster than the increase in salaries of employees and workers in this country. Problems in the supply chain, the war in Ukraine, and high demand for consumers have kept the prices of goods in the United States at the highest level in the past 40 years. In a report, CNN says inflation is rampant in the United States and the central bank's tool to fight price increases is to set higher interest rates. This makes borrowing more expensive and slows down the U.S. economy. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us for more. The New York Post writes, an analysis from the Heritage Foundation showed the average American has lost $4,200 in annual income since President Joe Biden took office. Experts at the conservative think tank said in a recent report the losses come down to surging inflation and higher interest rates. Their analysis found that the average American has lost about $3,000 in annual purchasing power because consumer prices, which have risen 12.7% since January of 2021, have spiked significantly faster than wages. Wages have risen just 8% over the same period, which has effectively resulted in a pay cut for Americans struggling to pay for daily necessities, including food, gas, and rent. Higher interest rates and borrowing costs have also reduced the average person's purchasing power by another $1,200. E.J. Anthony, a research fellow in regional economics with the Heritage Foundation's Center for Data Analysis, says, simply put, working Americans are $4,200 poorer today than when Joe Biden took office. He added, this financial catastrophe for American families is a direct result of a president and Congress addicted to spending our money, combined with a Federal Reserve compliantly enabling this addiction by printing more dollars. E.J. Anthony added, now the U.S. Federal Reserve is finally fighting inflation, which is pushing up interest rates and increasing financial costs. Rates on all kinds of consumer debt are rising. Mortgage interest rates have doubled since Joe Biden took office, greatly increasing Americans' monthly payments. Concerns about persistent inflation were renewed recently when U.S. Federal Reserve data showed consumer prices had increased 8.3% in August compared to the same month 1 year earlier, a figure that was worse than what economists had been expecting. The British newspaper The Guardian explains more about the same issue. US Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell warned recently that there would be pain ahead as the US central bank struggles to contain a surge in inflation unseen in the past 40 years. The U.S. Federal Reserve announced another sharp rise in interest rates on Wednesday afternoon, 21st of September, after the conclusion of its meeting. It also updated its economic forecast for the U.S. economy. Economists said the Fed raised its benchmark interest rate by 0.75 percentage points, the third such rise in a row, and plans to raise interest rates again in the coming months. The interest hike comes as central banks around the world are increasing rates to tackle a soaring cost of living crisis. Last year, the U.S. Federal Reserve dismissed inflation as a transitory issue triggered by the pandemic and supply chain issues. But consumer prices have remained stubbornly high and have remained so despite a change in the U.S. Federal Reserve's view and its aggressive interest